Well, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our presentation on the suggested framework for determining risk margins. I use suggested because it is an information note, so used for the calculation of regulatory capital. Good to see such a packed house here today. Thank you for all turning up. So today there's three of us will be presenting, Brian, Jess and myself. I'll quickly go through bios, although you probably know us all. So Brian's a partner at KPMG and has, as she puts here, a long-dated interest in risk margins.
You do.
And has been on a number of previous task forces to do with risk margins. Jess is a senior manager in BT Life, actuarial team, and has 10 years experience in insurance and banking. And prior to joining BT, she was with TAL, where she was involved with capital management. And then me, I'm Rob D'Souza, I think most of you know me, partner at EY, and I've worked out that I've had over 30 years in the financial services or insurance. I've realised I'm getting old when I do things like that. So the draft information note was issued last Friday, and we will be looking for feedback over the next 4 weeks, which I think is about Friday the 13th. We sent it out without actually saying that, but it will start coming through in the sort of the follow-ups, and you'll sort of get mentions in the bulletins. There'll also be further liaison with other committees as well, like the GIPC. So we're working through that. Our target really is to sort of try and get it out before the end of the year, but there are quite a few hoops to go through. I realised this when we actually got this one out, so we're hopeful rather than certain about that date, so we'll keep you informed as things progress through. So the aim of today is to sort of to walk through the key components of the framework. We're actually focusing on two of the sort of key margins, the random stress margin and the future stress margins. There are other margins. We feel the framework can apply to that. We might touch on them briefly. It's more about sort of how this framework works. Because the idea behind this task force was to develop a framework for sort of consistently determining risk margins. It doesn't actually sort of say this is the risk margin for a particular company or anything. It is more about framework for how you build up and get consistency from product, from different products, from year to year. But it does still leave an element of judgment in that process. It doesn't remove it, it just provides a framework to sort of base it on and keep that consistency. The framework should also sort of facilitate sort of a more transparent communication, as sort of the ranking concepts are sort of less technical and more intuitive, and that makes it easier to explain and encourage ownership from management and the board. So that's why it's been developed in the way it has, is sort of to try and get that sort of that approach. We also think that the ranking concept could also facilitate improved risk management discussions, because again, you're sort of talking about which risk is, you know, where is it more risky and less risky, and get that sort of flow. So we've been developing this sort of framework over a couple of years. As we've been developing and drafting it, we have actually encouraged a couple of organisations to use the framework in determining their risk margins. And a couple of others have actually also sort of started but not yet implemented. So we will, in today's discussion, sort of touch on that and sort of some of the learnings. So it's over to Jess to talk about the random stress margins. We're quite happy for people to ask questions on the way through, but we've also will have some time at the end to for questions. So, Jess, over to you. I didn't put the agenda up, sorry.
Thanks, Rob. Okay. So I'll be talking about the random stress margins, and just a quick recap. The random margins are to be applied for 12 months from the valuation date. What the random margin does is it tries to capture the random fluctuations in the claims experience. So in setting them, APRA has said that we should consider a number of factors. They include the expected claims, the distribution of the sum insured, and also any reinsurance arrangements. So So in the framework, we've proposed three different ways of setting the risk, the random stress margins. The first approach is a full stochastic approach. Now in this approach, it requires you to have all of the policy data at an individual level, and then this approach stochastically simulates the claims experience for every single data point. And then, as opposed to this approach, we also proposed a statistical method whereby you actually fit a distribution onto your portfolio of claims. So this compared to the statistical approach, doesn't require as much computing power, but it is more difficult to actually calibrate the parameters when you're actually setting the distribution. As a compromise, we also have said that you can use a simplified statistical approach. What that does is you try to group all of your data into homogeneous groups. For example, you want to group them into, say, a band of sum insureds or age, etc. So that way it reduces your computing time, but then it also tries to represent your underlying claims portfolio. Now, in deciding which approach to take, I think it depends on what sort of data you have, the materiality of your book as well. For retail policies, you probably do have the policy data, so you can implement a statistical or a simplified statistical approach, or a stochastic approach. But for group policies, where if you don't have the data, then potentially a statistical method may be applicable. When setting the random margins, in the LAGIC standards, there is diversification allowed for between mortality and morbidity risk. So in that case, you'll need to set them separately for morbidity and mortality. However, because it's random margin, you can actually set them at a total aggregate portfolio level combining your different businesses. So you don't need to set, say, one for your retail portfolio and one for your group portfolio. The diversification benefits between those portfolios you can combine. And so therefore, we anticipate that for companies that have a large book or have very diverse products, we would expect those companies to have smaller random margins compared to companies that are smaller or have one line of business. That's all I'll say about the random margins. Now I hand over to Brian Allen. She'll talk about the future margins.
Thanks, Jess. The second risk margin component for mortality and morbidity is the future stress margin, and this is the area where the task force spent most of its time. It's probably the most subjective element of the APRA capital standards for life insurance companies. The capital standard for relatively capital standard for it is, of course, LPS 115. This standard states that margin has to be calculated at the 99.5% probability of sufficiency. The margin should reflect the extent to which your mortality or morbidity assumption might change in 12 months' time. And it should reflect reasons why your long-term assumption might be wrong. So these are trends and experience which you don't know about yet, trends and experience which you might know about but don't consider yet credible, so haven't yet reflected in your assumption. Areas where your experience investigation might not be adequate in terms of process, data support, data sufficiency, etc. The task force has identified a framework which can be used to set the margins. We're by no means saying this is the only appropriate means by which you could set the assumptions. I'm going to walk you through an example of it first, but I thought it might be helpful just to talk around some of the strengths and weaknesses of the approach so that you can think about it as we walk you through the example. As mentioned by Rob at the start, the task force's work was about creating a structured process to set the margins. We weren't around saying this is the right number, we're about a process. And therefore, it's not surprising that the strengths are around those sorts of elements. So we think the strength of the structure that we have is that firstly, it's straightforward, and by that I mean it's not overly complex. is transparent. So what we've aimed to do is take a lot of the actuarial judgment calls and actually make them clear what those calls are so that they can be scrutinised. And finally, it's consistent and risk sensitive. So if the risk that you've identified today, when you have a look at it again in a year's time, it's increased or decreased, the margin should increase and decrease accordingly. And similarly, if you have a look between products, if one has a higher risk than another, the margin should be higher or lower. So the weaknesses of the approach are therefore the things that we didn't focus on, which were the subjectivity involved in setting what the risk factors actually are and the calibration required. So essentially, how do you get that starting number? Once you've got your starting number, we think we have a framework whereby your risk margin, your future stress margin, will move consistently compared to that starting number over time. But the obvious weakness is what that starting number is. In terms of calibration and risk setting, there's a number of data sources, both internal and external, which you can use to assist you in this process. And we've listed some on the slide here, but I'm sure you can think of many more. And over time, I think that probably as an industry we'll start collecting more data in order to assist us with this process. And you can looking at the slide there, I'm sure many of you will look at it and think, well, a lot of that is actually part of the risk management function, and I should only go and talk to my CRO. And this is exactly what we think that a lot of companies will do, is that the actuarial and risk management functions will work closely together in setting those future stress margins. On to the example. So anyone who went to the Financial Services Forum in April last year, this is the exact same example that we walked through there. So hopefully, if you saw it last time, this will be a nice refresher. The first step in the process is to identify or agree the level of granularity that you want to set your margin. So this is by product. And you could set it at a really high level, so you could just go retail versus group, for example. Or you could set it at quite a detailed level, so you could set it by distribution channel. You could set it by open versus legacy products. You could set it by anything whereby you think those products are going to differ significantly in terms of their risk. The framework will obviously work best if you consider the riskiness of the different valuation classes. So if you've got different valuation classes and you don't think they're actually going to have significantly different underlying risks, then you may as well just combine them for this process and avoid that additional level of complexity. If you have too many classes, it'll get bogged down. If you have too few, you won't get the level of differentiation that you need coming through. The second step is to set the risk categories. And once again, the number of risk categories that you have is completely up to you. You want to consider how different your risks are. So for example, if when considering, well, what should the risk be for this sort of section, for your assumption setting process, and your assumption setting process, you've included the data into it, and you think, well, I've got this really strong data assumption setting process, I've got good spreadsheets, they've all been reviewed, the controls around them are good, the discussion that we have at the end in terms of, you know, how to allow for trends, that's really robust, I think all of that's really great, but my data coming in, I've got some anomalies there, I've got some things that I need to investigate, which I haven't got around to yet. But that kind of thing is saying, well, perhaps we should split that into two and we should have a data quality category and an assumption setting category. So to some extent, as you go through the process, the degree of granularity of the risk categories, I think, will become self-evident as you start to realise strengths and weaknesses and separating those out. Once again, however, we do say that you don't want to have too many risk categories because otherwise you end up with just too many little buckets that you need to make decisions about when you start losing the woods for the trees. We've separated these into internal and external risks, and I know that's a bit black and white, and that in reality you'll find that some risks are both internal and external, so I wouldn't get too caught up on, you know, is it an internal risk or is it an external risk? And I'd focus more on, have you got the right risk categories? The next step that you do is decide how many risk factors you want to have. So in this example, we have 5 risk factors, but you could have 7, you could have 10, you could have however many risk factors that you want. You want to have enough that you're going to capture the different levels of risk that you say, I think this is a higher risk than this product here, and I think it's a lower risk than that product, so I want to have a different risk factor. And if you start having too many, then you start introducing sort of a level of accuracy into your analysis, which is perhaps not justified. setting what those stress margins are for each risk factor, this is probably the big subjective element in the process. So what can the task force, I guess, give you in terms of guidance for setting that? Firstly, the task force considered that the stress margin should increase exponentially. So a level 3 margin should be sort of exponentially higher than a level 2, and a level 4 should be higher again. So we can give you sort of the pattern that we think it should go by, and that it should be exponential. The second thing that we can say is probably that you'll have the most data around what those risk factors should look like, probably at the lower levels of risk. I'm hoping here that nobody here feels they have a really strong understanding of what a level 5 risk might look like from personal experience in their companies. You're probably going to have most awareness around the level 1 and level 2. So I think it's a lot around focusing around using your data to set some of those lower levels and then using that to calibrate what you think the higher levels might look like. The third is looking back to some of those data sources that we talked about earlier in terms of what can they give you in terms of guidance for what these stress margins might look like. But finally, I think it's going to be something that will be refined over time as you grow into this framework and you sort of get a bit better understanding of how it should look like and what's going to work for you. The risk factors should be set such that every risk category, so from data quality through to legislative and legal risk, say, if you rate every single one of them as a 1, you'd say, well, the appropriate future stress margin for that product is 5%. If every single one of them was 5, you'd say the appropriate future stress margin for that product was 200%, if those were the stress margins that you chose. The next point that you do is you go through and you say, for each risk category, what is the risk I'm going to associate for each of my valuation classes? And here you can see that for classes A1 through AC and B1 and B2, we're saying that they're very low risk, they've got really good data quality, they're risk category 1. But D1 and A2, we've got some questions about, so we're going to rate them a little bit higher at level 2. But basically, we think all of our data quality is pretty solid, so nothing's very high. We then go through and do that for all of them, and we then take the risk factor and we transpose over it what the relevant stress margin is. So we take our 1 for data quality class A1 and we say that's a 5% stress margin. Step 5 is to calculate the average stress margin. So the first thing I want to say here is that we're calculating the average of the stress margins, we're not calculating the average of the risk factors. So if you can imagine that you have a product and let's say it's only got 2 risk categories and you've rated those risk categories a risk factor of 1 risk category of 5, if you average the risk factors, you'd end up with a risk factor of 3, which would give you a stress margin of 40%. If you average the stress margins, you end up with an average stress margin of 102.5%. You need to average the stress margins in order to get the exponential nature of that risk coming through into your margins. The second thing I would say is that we are just taking a straight average here. We're not allowing for the correlation or diversification between risks. And this is definitely something whereby, over time, if you thought it was important, you could introduce that level of complexity into the framework. At the moment, the task force doesn't have that level of complexity because we think that there probably isn't enough data to justify it in the first instance, and you'd probably just be introducing a level of, I guess, spurious accuracy into your framework. But certainly, if you think that you've got the data and you think that it's needed, go ahead and introduce. The next 3 steps, which I'm going to step through really quickly because I know we want to have enough time for questions at the end, is all about calculating the correlation between the products. So although we didn't calculate the correlation diversification between risk factors, we do think, or risk categories, we do think that you should allow for it between products, or at least consider whether you need to allow for it between products. So the next 3 steps, which I'm not actually going to talk to, I'm just going to say that they happen, is about calculating that diversification. This example is, these slides are available if you want to step through it, and I think this is also the example in the paper, which will walk through it in more detail if you want to walk through exactly how that diversification correlation matrix occurs. But otherwise, I think we're probably all familiar enough with how those get applied. The final 2 slides I want to talk about is that once we've come up with the framework, the task force thought that there's actually benefits from this framework apart from those which are that you end up with a future stress margin at the end of the day. And the first of those benefits is that it allows, I guess, the actuarial team and the risk management function to build an obvious network between them, as between them they work out what the appropriate risk measures that need to occur across the business are in order to assist everyone in setting those future stress margins at the end of the year, setting what those risk factors are. The second is that it allows actuarial teams to be more involved in the operations of the business, as you seek to, with risk, understand what the different levels of risks are with the operations of the business in order to most appropriately and accurately set that, and I think that's probably a good thing. The final is that because the framework is risk sensitive, it should create a mechanism whereby if you do a business action which reduces the inherent riskiness of a product, then that should flow through into a lower risk margin, and that should then flow through into your higher returns on capital. So potentially you can start getting business cases up which relate around reducing risk with having a financial metric impact at the end. There are a number of companies who have implemented wholly or partially the framework at the moment, and we wanted to share with you some of the learnings that from those companies, based upon a couple of people that we interviewed. So we don't necessarily want to say that these are all the learnings, but these are definitely some of them. And as I looked through the list, what struck me is that a lot of it related to talking to people. A lot of it involved the importance of having broad discussions and keeping an open mind when you're doing this process, to get as many people involved in the discussion as possible, because people know their section of the business far better than you do, and the more you can interact with them, the more you can understand how the risk of their part of the business has changed. It's going to impact upon how that factor should move from year to year. The second component was just the obvious one, which is that at the end of the day, you need to sense check. Once you've gone through all of that level of detail as to how each little risk compares to other ones and compares to the product or compares to other products, you have to have a look at the final number and step back and say, does that result actually look sensible? And it could be that the result is very different from what you originally intended, what you had originally thought before you got into it. But then when you go back and you have a look at your analysis, you say, actually, I think that this is the right answer. It's quite different from what I had before I started the process, but I think it's possibly the right answer. Or it could be that you go back and you have a look and go, yeah, I think we might have, you know, overcooked or undercooked something along the way. So I think when that sense check at the end, it's important to have an open mind, but also be quite critical of yourself at that point to say, does it stand up to scrutiny over time? I think I'm right on time to hand back to Rob to take us to wind it all up.
Thank you. I mean, I'm not winding it up here. It's really a case to open it up to questions. We can. I mean, we've got a couple of other stress margins in the pack for looking at later, in terms of the presentation. Really, though, we wanted to spend most time sort of around the framework and having a discussion of that. So it's really at this point. I'm going to move it on to the last page, which basically says questions. So yeah, it's really an opportunity now for anybody in the room or on the webinar to ask us the questions. I will also remind you have got time to read the paper. Take time to digest it, and feedback, as I've sort of said before, over the next few weeks. Friday the 13th again. I forgot to say that there will be a microphone coming around, which is just behind you. If you could speak into the microphone so those on the webinar can hear.
So the rating factors go from 1 to 5. And I want to know, that's obviously a relativity, right? So is that relative to the risks faced by the company? So every company is going to have a 5 or a couple of 5s, or is that relative to some external benchmark that if you don't have risks as serious as that, you may not have any 5s? Or what is it relative to?
I think that's a good question. I think it pretty much depends upon how you want to use the framework, in the sense of you might want to have a complete framework which says, well, I don't think I have any 5s right now, but if I were to have it, this is possibly what they would look like, in order that you better understand what 1, 2, and 3 look like. Or you might say, well, actually, I'm just going to calibrate it to the risk that I currently have. And if next year something goes sort of goes over the 5, then I'll put a 6 in. So it's really open to you in that sense as to how you want to use it.
Yeah, and this also ties in with risk management, where you actually consider the nature of your risk and you have a risk framework which goes from sort of low to extreme. And you may actually not at a particular point in time have any extreme risks, but you still sort of have that as a category that you want to reflect. So it's actually sort of something that works quite well with your risk teams. And so you sort of, that's why, again, we're suggesting you work quite closely with the risk teams for working out sort of not just the range, is it a 5, but, you know, what does an extreme risk look like? You know, you might never get a 200% margin. You might actually sort of say, but that's something that we potentially could see is occurring, so we want it there. We might sort of say, well, no, we're going to reflect it at that sort of level. But, you know, then if something does come out, you might actually then have to adapt your framework, which gets quite, well, it's not difficult, but it actually then sort of makes you rethink how you're going to do your comparisons.
Bruce Vincent. Rob, each of the risks seem to have the same weighting, and so back to a traditional risk management structure, there's usually chance of occurrence and then an intensity. So, or is it all wrapped into the inherent rating?
We've talked about whether you have correlations and felt that was over sophisticated. I think the intensity comes through in terms of that rating. If you think it's a certain risk has got low intensity, you'll come up with lower ratings. So I think that's how that flows through at this point. You can, as we sort of said, become more sophisticated. I think at this point, the judgment on those ratings is still quite subjective, and we need time to sort of bed that down before we start going more sophisticated in those sort of correlations.
But essentially, the chance of it occurring is already built into the framework. So the chance of it occurring should all be at the 1 in 200. So all you're capturing is therefore the intensity.
I understood that you're seeking consistency with General Insurance, which uses this framework. Do you have any war stories as to how they've gone with using it? I'm picturing that their risks get an awful lot more extreme than ours. Sort of an A380 goes down or a ship sinks, then their catastrophe is huge.
My understanding is that this was a framework which was proposed by the General Insurance sort of equivalent risk margin task force. When I've spoken to my General Insurance colleagues, and certainly I encourage everyone else to speak to their General Insurance colleagues, they tell me that by and large it has not been implemented. It's still kind of regarded as sort of a best practice approach, but there are a lot of companies that have actually implemented it.
Jamie Satch. First of all, I'd congratulate Task Force, because I actually, when I read it, found it extremely useful, and we've tried to implement parts of it in our risk margins, and we found it very, very helpful. One aspect that I found that I thought an alternative approach could be adopted was the sort of simple average when considering a sort of a future stress. Just simply because you can get anomalous situations, like you find a new risk you want to allow for that you consider low, and because you've introduced a new risk, you actually end up reducing your margin, your pre-diversified margin. Did you consider alternatives?
I think that that's actually something that we explicitly considered when we were setting setting it up. And I guess it's about making sure that you've got the right level of granularity and that you've got the right calibration, in the sense of if all those risks are sort of equal likelihood, then perhaps it is of a lower risk because you're actually saying, well, it's actually more diversified sort of than I thought it was, or potentially some of the other risks maybe they should be increased in magnitude. But it was certainly something that we considered when we were setting it. We didn't have the, I guess, the great answer to your question, other than that we had initially averaged the risk factors and we decided that wasn't appropriate. Then we went to averaging the stress margins. But there's all sorts of things you could play with in terms of, you know, squaring everything and taking the square root and that sort of thing to see if that gives you a better outcome for what you need.
And another thing too, when you're sort of partway through, you know, gone down a number of years and you've decided you need to consider more risks, it's really a case of rebasing your model. So you've got to think about recalibrating at that point, not just taking the average of a new risk being added on. So you sort of go sort of rebalance and recalibrate so you don't actually necessarily change the answer unless you feel that is actually the right outcome because you've got more diversified position.
Kristen, how do you satisfy yourself that this is 99.5% over 12 months? Or could I make it simpler? If it were changed to 99% or 95%, would you just change the risk factors?
I think this is something where it'll be refined over time. And this is definitely, I guess, the area where the structure is weakest in terms of what's the starting point. But there are certainly lots of data out there to give you some idea as to how extreme things can get. The example which I always use, I'm sure everyone's bored with, is the fact that, you know, when AIDS came in the US, you know, within, you know, it went from no impact on assumptions, no impact on assumptions, no impact on assumptions, no impact on assumptions. In the fifth year, people increased their mortality by 400%. So that sort of gives you an idea as to what an extreme might look like. So if you start going and having a look for data points, they're certainly there. You then have to decide, well, how relevant are they to, I guess, to next year, given that it's how might your assumption change next year, given where we are at the moment in terms of events. So it's not as though we have, you know, 4 years of AIDS behind us sort of thing. So there are lots of data points out there if you want to go use them to help. And also, if you start having a look at your historical, you can get a feel for what, you can definitely get a feel for what a 1 in 10 or a 1 in 20 looks like. And so if you compare your 1 in 10 or 1 in 20 to what you've said as your 1 in 200, you can start to get a feel for, well, are those ratios right?
Yeah, and also you have different confidence around different types of risks. And therefore, being able to sort of have a confidence around a certain set of risks, you can sort of use that as a sort of baseline. And then you can sort of not extrapolate, but use the same principles, the same framework onto different products or different risks. So it sort of helps you sort of go, well, look, we think this risk has a similar sort of shape, similar nature to this other one that we've got well quantified, so therefore we'll use the same sort of framework. And that's how you sort of widen it across from there. Of course, there is the other piece, which is where we've always talked about, is the whole initial calibration, which is the tricky piece. But we've already done work. You know, each of the companies have done work to come up with what they believe is their 1 in 200 position. So you're sort of calibrating back to that to inform you as to whether or not this framework is in the right ballpark. Are there any on the webinar or?
Not at the moment.
No.
I guess sort of pose some questions to the audience. Do you think that this framework will make the, will I guess remove some of the black box nature to the setting of the future stress margin and make it more transparent and make it more, I guess, able to be discussed by the business in general and owned by management as well as just the appointed actuary?
I think it definitely makes it more transparent, and to Rob's point, the way you positioned it up front I think is absolutely right. It's a framework which gives transparency within which you can make judgment calls and then allow people to understand your train of thought. So I think absolutely it enables discussion, enables transparency. Whether it will provide more control for or involvement of management in some of these aspects, I guess time will tell. I think a lot of the, you categorise the internal, external, and by your definition, external is beyond the control of the company. And the number that were internal, that's the area where potentially you can actually work with management to try to get a better outcome for the business. I think there's the opportunity. I'm not certain it will actually deliver in management becoming particularly interested in certain or improving certain aspects of their business.
Ross Kiwi. We've been sort of trying to implement this for a couple of years, and we've got to the point, and I live in the corner, so I don't deal with management, so the actual dealing with management I'd have to leave to someone else. But we have got to the point where, so across the risk factors, we can now say when we get to our final PCA, how much of that is driven by each of the risk factors. So we've got the information there that can help with that conversation. So you can get to that without too much work at all.
Yeah, in response to those comments, what I see here is that there is a great similarity with the risk management approaches, and that is sort of the first step into management, if we're going to call it that, and engagement with the board in terms of an easy way of sort of saying, well, is this a big risk or is this a little risk? What do you feel is more risky? And it makes it a lot easier, and aligns to sort of risk appetite types of conversations. So you might be right, but it might be that it's a sort of a stepping stone as you go through, sort of saying, if you do make changes, this is the consequence that will have on your capital. So maybe then once you start, you may get the buy-in. Yeah, you're right, time will tell.
To pose a different question to the audience, I guess, is this the sort of thing that you're hoping that this task force would deliver? Or were you very hopeful that we would somehow magically tell you that the answer is 42 and just put this into your stress margins and that would be the answer?
I think it's really good and it's very helpful, and as Ross said, maybe I'm the one dealing with the management, but anyway. And it's very helpful to, over time, explain it, so that's very useful. But I think you talked about you can go and find your own data points to get this 99.5. And questions from our board, to me, is how do you know this is 99.5? And I think that would be when the task force has got some time, just to sort of get those sort of data points and put us in the right direction might be quite helpful on certain things, mortality, TPD, IP, lapses, just be quite helpful to, because it's quite hard. I mean, because on the market stresses, you have all that information and it looks like that. So maybe at every board I get this, but how do I know it's 1 in 10? How do I know it's 1 in 200? How do I know it's 1 in 50? And it's sort of a difficult question to answer.
It wasn't actually part of this work, but I think at the same time you published your survey of industry margins that were actually being held by different companies, and you split them between small and large companies. I actually found that extremely useful as a way of calibrating margins we were coming up with and getting a sense of were we at the extreme either way or were we kind of in the middle. And I suppose coming back, one of the things the framework does give is another way within the bounds of commercial considerations that companies in the industry can actually see whether their judgments or an individual's judgment is out of line with perhaps industry practice. So I don't think potentially another benefit for the framework that you've actually brought together. Won't necessarily get you to 1 in 200, but we'll know that we're all wrong consistently.
So again, I appreciate it. I'm glad you haven't given us an answer. So when I... you look at the different risk factors and choose. You're setting your TPD incidence for a group business. Well, what it's done for us, it said, right, we've got to go and look at all our big schemes and go, what is the definition that we're using, and what is the profile of this? What industries are they in? How exposed are they to the economy? So it's actually helping us go, what are the risks? What are the... We're not just going, oh, it's group and whatever. We actually have to dig down and go, what are the things going to drive volatility in our claims? So, I mean, to me, that's one of the great values of following this sort of framework, is going, looking and understanding better.
And Ross, you obviously spent a lot of time, you've obviously done a lot of data. Would you be happy to share with people how many hours or what sort of effort it's taken to do that, to implement it the first time?
It's probably been about, I mean, I'm only 3 days a week, but it's been about a third of my job since the word LAGIC was first mentioned. So, yeah. That amount of effort, yeah. Some people say I don't work too hard, they never see me doing anything, so...
So, no further questions. I'm just sort of checking. We're checking the screen to see if there's anything coming in. But, well, I suppose an early finish is a good finish. So, I'd just like to finish then by thanking you all for attending, and thank you for the questions that we got, and thank you very much.